You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Scholarly journals are the lifeblood of academic communication. They're where academics share their knowledge with their peers, as well as journalists, funders, and potential collaborators. But is there scope to think outside of the traditional tome? I'm Sarah Custer, and joining me today is Helen Wolfenden, a lecturer in radio at Macquarie University and a former radio broadcaster herself. And she has produced a podcast called Making Practice Publishable that we'll be listening to shortly. Hello, Helen. Welcome.
Hi, Sarah.
Helen, do you want to start off by telling us just why you've chosen a podcast as this medium for academic communication?
Look, it's a bit of an experiment, Sarah. I mean, it all gets meta pretty quickly in my world. But, you know, my background, as you said, I worked as a broadcaster. I teach radio and podcasting to students, but I'm also required to do the academic work of research and scholarship and creating new knowledge. And we did that in a piece with my co-authors, Howard Sercombe and Paul Tucker. We wrote a formal academic piece looking at the question of how it is that practice knowledge gets translated into academic understanding, and most specifically, what needs to happen to make practice knowledge publishable. And this was a paper that we came to based on work we had done to convert Paul's very first attempt at writing an academic paper into something that could be published, because he ran into some troubles, and in the end we sort of helped him out. And as practice-based academics, as Paul and I are, Paul's a TV director, I said, you know, there's some useful ideas in this that we need to talk about for those of us who come from practice backgrounds about what it is we need to do to convert our practice knowledge into the academic form. And we did that research, and because I was, you know, part of the process, we used interview-based techniques to gather the data. And I worked in audio because that's what I do. I always filter my knowledge back through my program making frames. And so I kind of effectively made like a little mini podcast for us to do the data analysis from. And Howard Sercombe, who's also my husband, said to me, you should publish that. Like, that's really interesting. And that's got the voices in it. And I thought, yeah, that's cool. I'll just convert this thing that we did in the research space to something that, you know, to a way of telling the story of the academic paper in a different form. There was a lot more work to do that than I had expected, because it's actually quite a different thing to be interviewing and processing information when it is about data than it is about a conversation that you're designing for people to overhear. So it's been a really interesting journey, but, the experiment for me was, could we use the narrative techniques of podcasting, the storytelling craft, to tell the story of a journal article? And so that's very much what the podcast version is. It's very different to the academic paper, but it lets you hear the voices of the people who are involved in the research, and I think hopefully brings the knowledge to life in a completely different kind of way.
Obviously, podcasting has become quite popular outside of academia. It's a very accessible way of communicating. Anyone with a smartphone and a microphone can just kind of set up a podcast and start doing it. Do you have any tips or practical ways that professors or lecturers could bring podcasting into their own class assignments and assessments?
Yeah, look, I think it's an extraordinary medium. I mean, I would say that, wouldn't I? Because that's what my professional life has been about, spoken word, broadcasting, audio, podcasting. But I think, you know, the academic space was really early into podcasting. In fact, in many ways before even those of us with audio storytelling backgrounds were. And I think academics really saw the potential. It's a great medium for communicating ideas. But I think for those of us who specialise in the space, we want to think about some of its other powers. It's a brilliant immersive medium if you are able to really kind of harness sound in the storytelling. But it represents a range of opportunities in the academic space because it's really good at connecting, because it uses voice. And, you know, voice is this kind of core human element. And I think, in fact, taking away pictures really allows us to focus on content and make a connection that filters out some of that other noise that pictures can sometimes bring. And it also, so I mean, I think for people working in the academic space, that the great thing about podcasting is that there's a podcast on kind of everything. That can be a blessing and a curse. But there may well be podcasts out there that supplement academic materials that students are more readily able to connect to, depending upon, you know, where they are in that kind of tertiary education journey. So as a sort of a way of providing information in the academic space, there is often a range of resources out there. But I think also as a tool for assessment, you know, the potential for it to be less threatening, particularly for students who feel challenged by written forms, or, you know, if there's access and equity issues, or second language issues for people whose written language might represent a challenge. There's opportunities in the assessment space to use podcasting as well.
Well, we're about to get a very good example of how podcasting can translate and map into an academic setting. Your episode is meant initially for practice-based academics, but I think it's got some really good tips and pointers and encouragement for anyone who's looking to get published or understand the publishing world of academia who might be quite new to it. What do you hope some of the takeaways are from the episode we're about to listen to?
It's quite long, I think. But the beautiful thing about podcasting is, of course, you don't have to try and digest it in one chunk. You can take it at your own pace. And if you know, pause and take a break, you could do that. But, you know, I think, as you say, there's lots of, you know, it was a really genuine question for particularly Paul and I and Howard, who came from a practice background as well, about trying to understand what we call multiple epistemologies, the different ways in which truth making happens in the academy versus in other spaces, in other professional spaces, and the need to translate knowledge between different forms of what becomes, you know, what becomes the sort of recognized forms of truth in particular professional spaces. So, you know, I hope it's valuable from that point of view. I hope it's valuable as an interesting model. I think it's probably the first time, you know, anyone please correct me if I'm wrong, that somebody has tried to turn a journal article into a narrative podcast. So it is very much an experiment. But, you know, it would be interesting, you know, because there is a formal academic article that sits in the Journal of Social Epistemology. So as a point of contrast between, again, this translation between forms of knowledge and how people access knowledge most readily, I think having knowledge available in different forms, having different points of connection, just helps us communicate effectively and to more people, I hope.
It's good to know that there is a journal article attached to this podcast just for the people who need that traditional formatting. So I will be linking to that in the notes for this episode. But meanwhile, Helen, thank you so much for your time today, and thank you for this brief intro.
Yeah, it's been my absolute pleasure, Sarah.
Right. And now we are listening to Making Practice Publishable from Helen Wolfenden.
This is a story about, well, let's say it's a story about two houses. You could go Game of Thrones style high drama, or if you're old school like me, Dune, House Atreides and House Harkonnen. But you'd be disappointed. It's a big story though, and an important one. The age-old fight for knowledge and truth. You see, there's this problem with the way knowledge works, and it's probably been some form of this for a long time in different fields of expertise. So, say, medicine or engineering or management or IT. Within those fields, there's a house, the academy, perhaps, or universities, or disparagingly, the ivory tower, whose job it is to create knowledge by conducting research. Then there's this other house, which is where people do the stuff in practice. Some people call it the real world or in real life. You know, the actual job of being a nurse or a social worker or managing people or making television. The problem is that both places create knowledge, but they find it hard to talk to each other about how they do that. And they have completely different sets of rules for what counts as knowledge and how that knowledge becomes truth or is validated. So we're missing out. knowledge gets created in the house of academe that doesn't make it over the bridge to the house of practice. And knowledge from the house of practice isn't able to find its way back into the research of the house of academe, particularly in academic journals, which is where research is often reported. Now, like all epic tales, this is also a story within a story, and it's the little story that will help us tell the big story. The little story is about a paper that tried. It tried to move from one house to another, and it didn't go well. The paper was about how a piece of ordinary television was scheduled to air in the single most important television time slot of the year. The TV program was about Glaswegian pop idol winner Michelle McManus and her search for family ties in the Gaelic-speaking Hebrides of Scotland. It was screened on BBC Alapa, the Gaelic language station, at 9 p.m. on Christmas Day 2011, the primest of prime times. So where does the paper come into it? Well, let me take you back and introduce you to Paul Tucker. He's the person who directed the TV program Ish Misha Michelle, and he was also the person who tried to turn it into an academic paper. He can tell you how it all started.
There was a general call for papers from the Journal of Popular Television. They were doing a seasonal special about television of a kind of a seasonal nature. And a colleague of mine, Tony Grace, sent it through to me and said, "Have you seen this?" Because he knew that I'd directed a programme that went out on Christmas Day at 9 o'clock on BBC Alapa. I had never published a paper before. I'd never written, never tried to write one before. So I wrote an abstract, which I sent to Tony. Tony put a little bit of a bibliography in it, a couple of references in it. And then I sent it to the paper, the editor of the paper, saying, "I've never done this before. I'm practice-based. I've got experience of practice, but this might be useful." Tony had said to me, "They'll love it. They love practice-based stuff."
Now, Paul has been making television all over the world for over 20 years. You name it, he's made it. Documentaries, reality TV, talk shows, children's shows, all sorts of things. Over 100 hours of television. And now he works in a university, teaching students how to make television. So why the big deal about trying to write an academic paper? Why bother? Especially if you've never done it before. Because in this new world Paul works in the House of Academe, the big game in town, not quite, but almost the only game in town, is academic publishing. Given my own never-ending struggles with this, I've been reading yet another academic self-help book to try and get better at publishing. It's called Write No Matter What. That tells you something, right? And it's by Jolie Jensen. As she puts it on page 18, "Rightly or wrongly, the measure of our professional worth continues to be our ability to write and get published. It doesn't matter how many BAFTAs you've got. In this house, it's all about how many publications you've got and their quality, as gauged by the status of the journals or publishers who've put your work out. The measure of our professional worth." Yeah, it's a big deal. So Paul sent his abstract off, along with his confessed inexperience, to Derek Johnson. Derek was guest editing this special issue of the Journal of Popular Television, which was focusing on television seasonality.
Paul had approached me with an informal email about the idea, which was a great idea for him, and I was really sold on the concept.
Sure enough, they got back to him and said, "Oh, I think this might be quite interesting. Why don't you write it?"
So Paul set about writing the paper. He contacted the people he'd worked with on making Ish Misha Michelle for BBC Alapa. He talked to the commissioning editor, Maggie Taylor, the head of the channel, Alan Esselmont, and the producer he'd made the program with, Patsy McKenzie. He wrote up some questions and he did some reading.
But not enough really to be called a bibliography. I read something the other day about saying that people with the least knowledge of things have the most confidence in their ability to do it. And I was a bit like that. I knew nothing really about the process, but I just set about it in the way that I imagined it kind of was done.
Paul sent his first ever attempt at an academic paper off to Derek, but it didn't go well.
When I got the first draft, I felt quite worried. too blunt, even though all of the ideas were in there, and I could tell that he'd also picked up on ideas that I'd mentioned in my response to the informal and to the formal proposal. It was not in a publishable format.
Derek knew the piece would need a lot of work, and despite wanting to see the paper succeed, he didn't know how much help he could provide, because Paul wasn't the only one grappling with firsts.
As this was my first go at editing an issue of a journal, I wasn't sure how much work that would actually be. And it wasn't the only article that we received that needed work either.
For one thing, Paul needed more words, so we put some dedicated time aside and had another go. I
went away to a writing retreat to get the word count up and sent in a reversioned version of the article. And they got back to me and they said, I don't think it's published within this first. They were quite abrupt. Gave me some nice feedback, but they were quite abrupt. They were essentially saying, this isn't going to work.
Well, I got the revised one from Paul, if I remember the sequence right. And again, that I was more worried then. Even though I could tell he put in a lot of work and it had paid dividends. And again, it was the ideas were there. The content was there. And I suppose one of my concerns was how much am I projecting onto it. It's like I knew that it could be turned around, but that it would need time. And that's why I suggested, can you find a colleague?
This is where I come into the story. I'm a bit like Paul, I guess, but I'm a radio person by background. I've worked as a presenter and a producer for both the ABC in Australia and the BBC in Scotland. I also did a PhD and ended up working in universities.
And it was at that point that I contacted you because they had suggested that I might want to get some help from someone who'd got more academic experience. So then I got in contact with you and you wrote Howard in, which is all good.
I was on maternity leave with all the sleep-deprived, addled-headedness that brings when Paul got in touch to ask if I might be able to help. But I didn't feel particularly competent either because I was very much a practitioner academic in the same way Paul was. I brought in my husband, Howard Sercombe, who has a long history of working successfully both as a practitioner and as an academic. In a completely different field, mind you. He's a youth worker by trade. But he's also done a significant amount of work analysing media and working with people making that transition from the house of practice to the house of academe.
And once it came back, having worked with the pair of you, I could tell that those are, you know, there's still a few little things maybe, but those ideas were much stronger, clearer. That's the main thing. It's the clarity of the concepts and the expression of the concepts. Not so much that the formatting's right, that's important, obviously, but that could be fixed, but that the ideas came across really clearly and that they've been explored.
So, good news, the paper got published. Pretty happy about that. The end. But, well, it wasn't the end for me. Now, this is all super meta, and yeah, when I say stories within stories, this is where we get next level, because I decided we should write a paper about the paper. The reason I wanted to do that is because I was like, I still don't get in enough detail what happened to that paper to be able to make it published. And I really want to know and understand that, because if I'm going to be a proper independent academic, I need to be able to do that on my own. And I still don't feel that I can confidently do it. So the reason the second paper happened is because I was going, what did you do, Howard? How did you change it? How did you get it over the bridge? And if that's a useful question for me and Paul, then it's probably a helpful thing for other practice academics who are also out there trying to make that happen. So we had some questions. Well, that's pretty evident. I mean, I've just reeled off a heap of questions, something of a question crush, you could call it. I guess you could call those questions, the ones I've just bombarded you with, you could call those our ruminating questions. These were the things we were tossing around that moved us to a decision that we'd write another paper. But to do research, you need proper, formal research questions. So let me try to lay those out for you. The first big central one was, How did you do it? How did you turn this piece of practice writing into something that an academic journal would publish? That was our overarching guiding question. But we also had some secondary questions, and I've tried to combine and condense them so they make a bit more sense when you're listening and not reading this kind of information. Number one, what stops people who are now academics but have practitioner backgrounds from publishing in academic journals? What are the barriers? Let's find out more about that. What's the wall they're hitting their head against? Numbers two and three. We can see from our experience, at least, that it's pretty hard for some practitioners to get their work published in academic journals. So what do you have to do to get your knowledge across the bridge, to convert practice knowledge into academic knowledge? And numbers four and five. If what you have to do to get things from one side to the other is translate, what gets lost in that translation process? What price is paid to convert from one house's currency to the other? We had three ways we answered the questions. We compared Paul's first two attempts at writing the paper with the one that was ultimately published. That's called a redaction analysis. We went back through our own process, talked to each other and the editor of the journal, Derek, who you've already met, and unpacked what had happened, which is called autoethnography. And we took the first paper, the one about the ordinary TV show that was screened in the most important slot of the year, back to the TV makers we originally spoke to. From them, we wanted to know what they made of seeing their work taken across the bridge and translated from the House of Practice to the House of Academe. That's called member checking. So let me introduce you to those guys. Alan was one of the big bosses of BBC Alapa at the time, the head of content. Maggie is the scheduler for BBC Alapa. She's the person who decides when the shows go to air. And Patsy is the producer who worked with Paul to make Ish Misha Michelle. The first bit of good news is that they thought that the paper was an accurate reflection of what had happened.
I was really engrossed from the start because, like anything else where you've been forced in the nicest possible way to analyse something you've made, it's just a really healthy exercise. I thought it was a brilliantly written paper that took a really good slant on the analysis you were trying to do.
That was Patsy, the producer. Maggie, the scheduler, found it helpful for laying the whole process out in front of her.
Because we had never written what our thought processes were or why we did anything, so it was actually quite clear to see it in paper and sort of thing. That might have been what we did.
And Alan said,
"You had, if you like, inside information on the way it worked anyway. I thought it was very fair, and it was good contribution, if you like, to work in Scotland."
Although that didn't necessarily mean they could get completely on board with our next tier of analysis. Paul reads Alan a quote from the paper. The quote makes the point that perhaps it's the loss of connection with ancestral clans and lands and a draw to a simpler way of life, especially on Christmas Day, right, that's in the back of the commissioners' minds when they decide to fund something like Ish Misha Michelle.
Is this deeper picture in the minds of commissioners as they decide to put up the money for Ish Misha Michelle, or in thinking of the production team as they put the programme together, or in the minds of the schedulers as they decide that this piece of ordinary television, this summer travelogue, will work on Christmas Day?
I suppose, short answer, no.
Alan says it was the appeal to both BBC Alapa's core audience, the Gaelic-speaking population, as well as the draw that Michelle McManus had for the broader Scottish population, as well as the fact that it was just a really good program, really high quality. These were the reasons it was scheduled where it was. And this is one of the really interesting findings for us as we tested the paper and our analysis back with the people who supplied the original information. As the authors of the paper, we wanted to see how the program makers connected with the layers of academic analysis. But for Alan, Maggie and Patsy, it was the program they connected to and wanted to talk about. It was their program maker colleagues' experiences of making the program and the reflection of their own experience that were the most compelling aspects of the paper. They wanted to talk about Ish Misha Michelle, but the House of Academe wants something very different. That said, the detail that remained about the program still offered new and useful insights for Patsy, Maggie and Alan, who all operate at different points in the program-making process. The paper gave Patsy, an experienced TV producer, new insights into commissioning and scheduling.
Personally, it's very interesting to hear what my commissioner had to say, not having been party to that through the process, and what Maggie, the scheduler, had to say. And to, I mean, one of the lovely things was an overwhelming feeling that we're all rowing in the same direction in terms of Gaelic television per se. And for me, yeah, it probably did make me realise that there was a far bigger value to Ish Misha Michelle McManus than had existed for me personally as producer at the time, because as producer, it's all about the idea, it's the creativity, it's the spin, it's the story, and it very quickly becomes your baby, and you don't tend to look any further than that. You've got your budget signed off, you may not have a clue when it's being broadcast, as you expanded on that a lot in the document, that you're usually working in the dark, we've no control over that. So, yeah, it made me really proud, actually, to be honest, to have been a part of it. And I found it, yeah, very, very useful.
Patsy found she could potentially apply some of the notions of seasonality that were expressed, but again, those that came from her commissioner rather than the theory.
And it was interesting as well what Alan said at Christmas, BBC and BBC Scotland and STV are invisible. And that kind of really made me think, because I'd never considered that before.
One of the barriers between House of Academe and House of Practice is that for people who've only been on one side of the bridge, it can feel like the other side is inaccessible. Patsy and Maggie are not connected to academic research as a potential source of information about how they do their job or the practice of making TV more broadly.
Well, I can only speak very personally here. It never has for me, but then that's probably as much to do with the fact that I didn't pursue higher education for a start. So I think it's almost as fundamental as that.
No, probably not, to be honest. It doesn't mean that I wouldn't read it if somebody sent it to me. But would I go out looking for it? But then again, I probably never thought there was anything out there that was of any relevance to the art of scheduling. If I had known there was a book out there, I probably would have got the book to find out if there was anything I could take from it.
Might start thinking about that book.
A short book.
Maggie reflects a feeling that's common in the House of Practice, and that's a suspicion that the academic process doesn't really have the capacity to capture the work she does, and there are certainly limitations to the work that academic research can capture. There are both commercial sensitivities and sensitivities between different parts of the practice process that have to be considered. This snippet of a conversation between Paul and Patsy explains it well.
I often wonder whether you'd ever be allowed to really get to the truth in this kind of paper if you were talking to people who, particularly people that you didn't know, about things that are slightly business sensitive.
I know.
You know, so, you know, maybe Alan, you know, maybe he was a bit reluctant to say, I had to schedule it there because I paid a little bit extra for it. I do wonder about that sometimes and these kinds of papers.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect you're right. I mean, the whole kind of, yeah, commercial sensitivity about it.
Patsy also points out that she's still pitching programs and trying to get them made within the system that's under examination in the research, and that means she has to be a bit careful about what she says.
I'm not saying that this exercise is asking you to defend yourself, but in a way it kind of is, because it's exposing it completely, and you know you're bringing in the people to whom I still have to go and sell things. And yeah, it does, but that's, I think, quite healthy, because, you know, you should never go in thinking you know it all and that you got everything right.
because you're talking about the way you work, and you know that Maggie, the head of scheduling, and Alan, the head of the channel, are going to read a little bit about your working methods and what you're thinking.
Yeah.
It's probably Maggie who's most dubious about what the House of Academe can offer her house of practice. She relies strongly on gut instinct, and she doesn't believe that's something that can be effectively captured by research. Maggie talks about the dark art of scheduling, and Paul asks her if the paper had shed any light on this mysterious process.
Has reading this paper made you sort of shed any light on
the dark art? No, I think it's still very much a dark art. A lot of the time you know what's going to work, and you know where it might work or where it might not.
But Maggie's also thinking about the future and what happens to the person who steps into her role once she moves on. She wonders about how a 20-year-old would do the job. Maggie spent a lot of years working in radio before she moved into television and almost kind of evolved with TV. Paul pushes the topic a bit further.
But when that 20-year-old, let's say 25-year-old, comes along, is there any chance that you'll point her or him to this paper and say, well, have a look at that, that might be something?
Yeah. And the dark art, go with your gut. It's not always about numbers and what looks good on paper as to what will work on paper doesn't necessarily work once it's made and out there. But yes.
Maggie sounds a lot more sold on gut instinct than anything we have to offer, even if you're young and inexperienced. Although that hypothetical 25-year-old scheduler is going to be a native of the brave new world of non-linear on-demand programming, which is a whole other kettle of fish. But there's another problem associated with the experience required to effectively apply the dark arts as Maggie knows them.
At the moment, you know, the few schedulers that there are in the country are all pretty much the same age. That I did figure out a wee while ago because we were all in a course together and we're all on the same age. The nation's schedulers are exactly the same age.
So it would be... This might not be the way, but it would be quite a good idea if someone was collecting together the collected wisdom and thoughts of the schedulers of the nation.
Because it'll all go away in the same day.
See, I think that last point is really interesting. Maggie can see that the knowledge she holds is fragile, even if that's only because it can't be captured. And then there's all these other complicating factors. The information is sensitive, it's commercially valuable, it's hard won. You don't want to give that up easily, and it can't necessarily be readily documented. But it's also going to vanish if there isn't some form of collection of it. Perhaps the Academy isn't the place to be doing that. Perhaps that's something the BBC should be doing. While the new program makers coming through the ranks will often have the blended practical and theoretical training, for those who've come through the previous system, where there wasn't a connection with academic analysis, it's on-the-job experience that is still the key to learning the trade.
That is king of the castle for me, but I would never, ever dismiss this kind of thing.
Patsy also has a story about how those who've been through the new model of House of Academe training are using and connecting with this kind of knowledge.
And actually, it's really interesting because Ailey was printing it off for me yesterday because my thing had run out of juice, and Ailey did her placement with me at Sorbet and now works for me from time to time. She had to read it from beginning to end and found it, you know, really quite, you know, she was beaming sort of reading it over lunch and picking up on one or two things in the sort of, oh, I'd never thought of that sense.
So things are looking promising for finding a way over the bridge. Having looked at it from the House of Practice side, let's go over to the House of Academe and see if we can work out what on earth it is they're doing. So just to check in and make sure you're okay here, because like I said, this is a saga, we've got these questions we wanted to investigate about how the paper that tried and almost failed got turned into something that the House of Academe was prepared to accept as knowledge, as truth. We took the paper back to the people from the House of Practice and found that they thought the paper was accurate and really interesting. They liked what they read, but they didn't always buy the academic interpretation that went with it. What they were interested in were the bits of the paper that talked about the program and their experiences of making it. So why did the paper even have to change in the first place? Why wouldn't the Academy just accept the first versions that probably had more of what practitioners wanted to hear? Well, because theory. And I'll explain that. But before I do, let's recap our big question for the House of Academe. How was the paper that tried rescued from imminent death? And how did the paper go from being practice-based and unpublished to published in an academic journal? How did we do that? Howard Sercombe is our guide here. Howard's been an academic for over 30 years, but he's also a practitioner, not making media like me and Paul, but a youth worker. He's an honorary professor of education at the University of Glasgow and currently lectures in criminology at the University of New South Wales. He knows his stuff when it comes to political and social theory, but if you ask him, first and foremost, he'll tell you he's a youth worker. Howard describes the process he went through to bring the paper back to life, to do the work Derek, remember him, you met him earlier, he's the editor of the journal, to do the work Derek needed.
There are rules, right? So for the presentation of a piece of work as research, there are formal rules that it, and this is true for any production of any discourse, you know, you can't get a piece of television published if the credits are not in place or, you know, all of that sort of stuff. In the first draft, those requirements were not met.
I think that's very fair, and it strikes me that it's a bit like, you know, a TV format. There's no point going in as a director of Bargain Hunt and saying, I've got all this great material. I've just decided to structure it slightly different from the, all of the other hundreds and hundreds of versions of Bargain Hunt. You just have to make it like Bargain Hunt. You know, you can still get in that content, but it has to hit all the format points that Bargain Hunt hits, you know, and I didn't know any of the format points, or I loosely understood some of them.
The piece had to be reframed to fit the shape of an academic research paper, and while the pieces needed were often there, they were a bit buried, so they needed to be drawn out more clearly.
A lot of what the work was to put the standard skeleton of a research paper in place and shuffle bits around, sometimes recombine them, until they fitted that skeleton.
There's a couple of other things I reflect on from this restructuring Howard did. He makes it all sound easy, but to me, trying to see myself doing this, putting skeletons on things and shuffling and recombining things, still sounds really tricky. You need to know your turf well to be able to drop in and see where and how those changes needed to be made. And if you're making the transition from practice to the academy, chances are you don't know that turf very well. So partnerships and collaborations are important. They help you learn the ropes of getting the form and structure right.
So the short answer to your question is what I needed is that I needed people that knew what they were doing, really, to couple with my quite good understanding of how TV works.
By making changes to the structure and form, the paper becomes a much more orthodox piece of academic writing, and we were able to confirm that this happened, and the other changes we're talking about here, with the redaction analysis and the autoethnography. There were also some things that were not there and needed to be. And this is where we come to one of the big things that needed to happen for the paper to cross from the bridge of one house to the other. It needed theory, because theory is centre stage in the House of Academe. Paul had some theoretical concepts in the paper, but not enough, and they were scattered. Howard pulled all the bits into one place and added some more, including a big picture theorist, Stuart Hall. There needed to be a clearer discussion about methodology, which is how he actually did the research. So for that paper, it was semi-structured interviews, and making sure that you're doing it in a way that means it's not bogus. But why is theory such a big deal for the House of Academe?
The cliche, and it's a lovely one, about a science being about standing on the shoulders of giants kind of stuff. The way in which academic pieces don't stand alone, they're not supposed to stand alone. You know, they're not short stories. what they're supposed to do is connect to the much longer history of talk about things, and it needed to be connected into that. So theory was one of the ways to do that, but then the introduction and conclusion were partly about saying, you know, it's the kind of story that's been around in academia for a while. These are the people who've talked about it. This is the next stage in that story.
It's worth thinking for a few moments about this word theory, because it gets used in different ways. In the academy, theory is a core explanatory framework. In practice communities, theory often means untested ideas, in the sense of, I have a theory about how we might do this better. And there's this idea of the theory practice gap as a long-standing explanation of why the two houses don't talk effectively to each other. And one understanding of the theory practice gap is that the House of Academe has all the theory and the House of Practice has, well, all the practice. But we're proposing something a bit different, and I'll come back to that, because there's a bit more to say about theory, given that this is one of the big ones for the House of Academe. Now, for the sake of time and complexity and space and having this make sense in your ears and not haranguing you for 15 hours, we're going to take some liberties here. Well, some more liberties. We're talking about theory and the House of Academe, for that matter, as though it's one big united entity. And of course, it's not. We're also talking about these ideas as though there isn't any contention or controversy about them. And that's absolutely not true. Lots of contention, lots of controversy. There's lots of academics who wouldn't necessarily recognise themselves in the House of Academe I'm describing, and who wouldn't describe theory in the way that we are. We're taking very broad brushstrokes, and this is disputed turf. The way we're framing it is to say that what theory does is it facilitates the transformation from the particular to the universal and context-free. Now, pretty much every word is preloaded with all sorts of other associated meanings in the House of Academe. So there are people who, for good reason, don't like the words universal or context-free. They might be more comfortable with saying that what happens with theory is that you have to move the ideas beyond the particulars and create an abstraction. And that abstraction is built in conversation with the existing theory. But the shorthand we're going with is this idea that theory enables us to move knowledge from the particular to the universal and context-free. And that's a big and important change that happened in the paper.
The discipline is to find ways to name what exactly it was at that point that meant this thing went that way rather than that way. And then you start to build that into a system and it becomes a framework, and then it becomes something that, you know, science is about the creation of knowledge that's universal, context-free, not only about that, but by being able to work with this very particular material and find the ways to name the critical points of that and build that into a system, then you've got something that becomes much bigger than this particular program on Christmas Day.
Theory is a big picture story, an abstract story. But there's another part of it too, something we might call the stripping out of agency. Because the individual actions of Paul, Patsy, Maggie and Alan in the making of this piece of television are cut away. Now, why on earth would you want to do that? Because in the House of Academe, it's not about individuals anymore. It's about what happens to a text, Ish, Misha, Michelle in this case, when those people do what they do, and then the impact that this text might have on potential audiences. So there's no individuals who are making decisions anymore. The powerful thing, the thing that's creating change, is the text itself as a kind of disembodied acting object. Theory can't deal with individuals because it can't make these bigger, overarching claims without removing the actions of individuals. In order to make the story universal, you can't have particulars anymore. They're too random. And that can be hard for someone like me to wrap her head around, because in my house of practice, making media content, it's all about individuals. Individuals like Michelle McManus and her story. That's why a TV show was made about her. So we now know that the paper that tried was transformed from a piece of practice writing into a piece that an academic journal would publish in these ways. It was restructured and reshaped to better fit the conventional academic form, and partnerships with more experienced academics who knew how to do that were created. Theory was beefed up, and pegging the ideas to these bigger bodies of knowledge moved the story from the particular, from the actions of individuals, to being universal and context-free. Indeed, for the most part, agency, the actions of individuals, was stripped out. Derek's insights also back this up.
For this journal, while I wanted the practice experience to be represented, it was also trying to fit in with, well, okay, what does practice tell us about these theoretical ideas about audience and season and nostalgia and family and so on? But when it comes to writing the articles, it's got to be finding a ground for communication. And so there've got to be those kind of shared references, those standardized styles and standards of engagement in the theoretical material.
And here's where I've realized I've been getting it wrong. I've been thinking that because we're looking at the same thing, we're talking about the same thing, and we're not. Television theory is using television as a representation to talk about bigger questions about our world. It just happens to be that television is the source of the texts that are under examination as representations of culture and society. Paul and I are talking about television, or radio in my case, with specific interest in the making of it. We're often not talking about the same thing at all. And the key theorist we used for this second paper, for the analysis we're doing here now, helps us to understand that. So let's try a quick bit of actual theory. We use the work of William James, who was born at the beginning of 1842. See, I go straight for the individual. He came from a very wealthy and privileged family, but he was pretty sick as a kid and young man. He originally trained as a medical doctor, but he never practiced. Instead, his life's work became about psychology and philosophy. James would argue that things are defined by their uses. So what a rock is depends on the perspective you're coming from. So it could be a weapon, it could be the raw material for a sculpture, or it could be something that you're going to use for building roads. It could be a jewel or a geological sample. So the rock is defined by the knowledge that the person who comes to it sees it with. Because the thing itself is just a thing. It becomes an object in the process of objectification. And that's an active process by the person who's observing it or describing it. So the way television is objectified by a television practitioner is really different to the way it's objectified by a television theorist. So if you're talking about two different objects, but you don't know that you're talking about two different objects, then it's no wonder you can't understand what each other is talking about, or why you're not as interested as you thought you might be. Because you thought you were talking about the same thing, but you're not. And if you read Derek's précis of our paper in the introduction to the special edition of the journal, which is where he gives a summary of each of the papers in this journal edition, we can see how different the paper looks to him than it does to Maggie, Patsy and Alan. Derek writes that our paper emphasises a particular characteristic of Christmas programming as being an extraordinary day which celebrates the very ordinary concepts of family and homecoming and shared experience and heritage. When Derek's considering scheduling, it's not from the perspective of people like Maggie and Alan, it's from an audience framing, saying it suggests the wider significance of scheduling as an underappreciated part of the way that audiences interpret and engage with programming. But there's something else I want you to consider, and that's a place where practice and theory come together quite effectively in the House of Academe. Teaching wasn't the focus of a specific question in our research, but it emerged in the conversations. Howard maps the terrain.
I think this is where teaching is the other part of the Holy Trinity that we're talking about, you know, with the practice and the academic writing, because it's in trying to teach people stuff that you've got no choice but to articulate it, to name it, to be able to somehow construct a narrative about it that sticks in people's heads and means that they can learn. And I think this is where you start to learn how to name the key elements of your own knowledge and of your own experience. You, for me, also you see where the gaps are in the published material. You know, you're trying to find something for your students to read, or there is a you know, the existing three books on it use this kind of framework, and you think, that's rubbish, you know, that doesn't work. And for me, that's always been a driver for research as well, you know. So in the mix between my own experience as a practitioner and the compelling force of what you need in order to teach it, and then saying, well, these are the gaps. This is where knowledge generation needs to happen. This is the kind of writing, this is the kind of research that I need to be doing.
It's in teaching that a practitioner academic can feel most at home in a university.
Now, obviously, I'd still feel more confident talking about scheduling and everything, but I could put together a class that talked about both the theoretical spine and the way in which it was written.
As a theorist, Derek is keenly aware of the teaching focus on practice.
The MA and undergraduate degree that I teach on are both very production heavy. Basically, I'm the theory. And when we talk to employers like the BBC, they say we want people who don't just know how to use the tech, but who will reflect, who do have a grasp of ideas of audiences. That, you know, they don't have to be able to quote Bourdieu on distinction, but they need to be thinking about taste and aspects like that.
So teaching is one of the key sites where the House of Academe and the House of Practice, at least in an ideal world, kind of come together. But that is often at a big cost to practitioner academics. One of the big and really important research questions that I outlined right up front that we haven't addressed yet is the one about barriers. What stops people who come from practitioner backgrounds but now work in universities from publishing in academic journals? These guys are often excellent teachers, but it's the publishing game that can be the big struggle. And publishing research is incredibly important as an academic because that's where the new knowledge is represented. And let's be straight, there's a lot of status and sometimes money attached to it. Paul explains his transition from being a practitioner to working in a university.
What was quite difficult, I think, when I moved from television, I was quite a senior level series producer, and it's quite difficult to start from scratch.
And perhaps more succinctly?
As a colleague once said to me, you might end up just being shit at both things. So that is a risk.
So you go from being really good at something, really senior, to being a beginner again, to having to learn a whole new set of skills that are really hard and pretty weird, at least if you're not familiar with them. But Paul sees the flip side too.
I mean, obviously, if someone spent 25 years or something working in the world of academia and preparing papers and everything, that they must know something that I don't know. They must have an understanding of that world and of the way it works and how to use it that I don't know. I don't know. They must do. And I can understand how there might be a kind of, what does he think he's doing coming in here writing academic papers? It just makes cookery programs. So I suppose the question I'm always asking myself is how much of this stuff do I need to know in order to work within it and to make it work and to talk about it competently without people saying, well, obviously there's a whole corner of this world that he doesn't understand. So I don't know what I'm missing, I suppose, apart from when I look back on this paper and I think, oh, I didn't do that, didn't do that, should have done that. Didn't do that, but don't think it really matters. I constantly fall back on this not particularly useful analogy with punk rock, but, you know, they just thought, well, we're just going to do it, really, and they did it, and And in a way, I just thought there comes a point where you just have to do it. What is obviously missing, from what I understand, is all of that theoretical background, and that allows a paper about scheduling one program on one particular time of year to allow it to talk about television as a whole and culture as a whole and society as a whole.
Yep, the theory stuff we've been talking so much about, and the move to universal, context-free knowledge. But Howard has some really powerful things to say about this question, because he's seen it operate in sometimes very painful ways, and he's seen some people badly damaged in this process. Remember, Howard, as a youth work academic, has spent his career transitioning practitioners into academic work. He says universities recruit advanced practitioners who are at the top of their game because they know their stuff.
They come in, there's a completely different game with a different set of rules. No one tells them it's a different game. It's not clear that it's a different game, but it's one in which they feel inadequate and small and unskilled and like they're just beginning, and they are, right? So there's a significant kind of humbling that needs to happen in order to begin as a very, very junior researcher in this new field when you are very, very senior in your substantive area. And because the university doesn't understand that's what's going on, often they're really punitive. You know, why aren't you doing research? They can be really judgmental in the sense that you are not writing papers because you're stupid. So the humility required to begin again in this new field can also be a set of ritual humiliations as well. You know, my beef is that universities themselves don't understand that these are two fundamentally different modes of truth-making, and that what works in one does not work in the other, vice versa as well, you know. And this is really what the theory practice conundrum is about. These are different kinds of knowledge and require active translation between them, and that's highly skilled work. And for practitioners who are coming into that and then being asked to drop into the only valued game currently, which in universities, which is the production of high status research, and without that stuff being understood, well, it creates huge suffering, actually.
The stakes are incredibly high, especially if you're a practice academic, but also for universities. It can be excruciatingly difficult to make the transition from a career where you have expertise and seniority to one where at one level you're a beginner again. And the process of learning how to research and write and produce knowledge as an academic is difficult. And often practitioners aren't well supported or understood as they try to build the skills they need. But here's one thing we found out that we thought was pretty cool about how practice academics work, anecdotally amongst us at least. We discovered that the three of us, as people from practice backgrounds, all translate our academic work back through our original practice processes. So, for example, when I'm doing academic work, coming up with research questions, designing ways to answer those questions and writing papers, it all happens as though I'm making a piece of radio. I realised this when I was doing my PhD. For the life of me, I couldn't design my research tool, which is the academic way of saying I was trying to write my interview questions for my research participants. It wasn't until I thought of them as radio guests and wrote the questions literally on the same template that I'd used to make my radio show that the questions started to flow. And from there, I could see the parallels between the radio making process and the research process, and how I could use my radio ways of working to help me make academic work. I'm calling these practitioner filters. And it makes sense that you'd work with what you know. You can hear Paul doing this too, reframing things back into contexts that he's more familiar with.
So it's just putting it in a context that allows me to not constantly talk just about the time I was working with Alan Titchmarsh, but put it in a kind of a theoretical basket and framework that makes it slightly more of a universal story than just anecdotal stuff.
Howard, who first trained as a theologian, does this too.
I probably filter things back through biblical frames.
Exactly, yeah.
Which brings us back to what I see as the core of our argument, the need for translation. We were talking earlier about trying to identify the core of the problem between the two houses trying to understand each other, and I said that it's usually described as a theory-practice gap. But academics are working with a practice and a theory, and practitioners are working with a practice and a theory. And their theories and their practices are different. It's not that one lot's got all the theory and the other lot's got all the practice. What we're saying is that it's an epistemological gap. And by epistemology, we mean the way knowledge or truth is made and recognised. So it's a gap between two different truth systems, which might sound like a theory-practice gap. But the important thing about recognising it as an epistemological gap is how that helps you work out what to do about it. And the big thing that's needed is translation. So we have to try to understand translation and how it might help get knowledge better working between the two houses. On one side, practitioner academics have to learn to translate if they're going to successfully move their practice knowledge into the academic space. And Paul respects the fact that to translate, you have to know how to speak the other language.
You need to kind of meet halfway, really. I think as a practitioner, you do need to take on some of the methods and vocabulary and ways of working that allow you to move into the academic world and to kind of talk partly with the same language, you know, and to be the translator.
But as Howard points out, if you want to translate, the first thing you have to recognise is that there are indeed two languages, two different houses, kingdoms, as he calls them, that have something to say to each other.
But you can't explore and enlighten the middle ground unless you understand the separate kingdoms as separate kingdoms.
So the benefit of all this is that hopefully the House of Academe gets better access to the real-world happenings from the House of Practice, and the House of Practice gets an enriched, bigger picture understanding of what's happening in their backyard thanks to the addition of theory. But there are limits. There are times that the House of Academe is not that interested in the practitioner perspective, and the House of Practice not so interested in the thinking of the House of Academe. So as Derek says, it can be a question of relevance.
With literature and so on, we spent so long fighting against kind of authorial intent to say, well, actually the audience can get different things out of this. That it can be easy to say, well, actually, we don't need to know what the practitioner was doing. At the same time, the practitioners be going, well, I've done it, so why do I need to fight through this person who's talking about the long-standing rituals of television and how Christmas and how they bring families together? I know, I've done it. So there can be that, well, why is this relevant question?
There's certainly a space where both houses want to do their own thing. And the other thing to bear in mind about translation is that even if what you're going for is hybrid vigour, you're going to lose something through the translation process.
It should give both communities something they didn't have before. And it may be that the practitioners go, yeah, well, that Stuart Hall stuff, I didn't bloody get into that, you know. Something is always lost. Something's always gained. You know, hopefully something's gained in a process like this. But you can't trade currency across the border without losing some.
To offer one of those practitioner filters again, Paul puts this translation work back into the context of program making.
When I talked to Patsy about the making of programs in Gaelic, obviously she speaks both languages, Gaelic and English, and you know, when we talk about what I think of a Finnish programme, I always say to her, no, I like it. Of course, I can't completely understand it. And she says, what do you mean? It's been, you know, it's got subtitles and everything. But as Howard says, and it's always tried to say to Patsy, something has got to be lost. If Gaelic is a language that's worth preserving and persevering with, if you translate it into English, it has to lose something. Otherwise, there's no point having Gaelic. We might as well always speak with the same language.
Howard builds on this point.
What you lose is that it's been translated. You know, so it's no longer in the native language of the original speaker, you know. and the native language of television people.
But strangeness isn't necessarily a bad thing.
That strangeness might be more of an advantage than a disadvantage. Now, to some extent, what poets do for us is to make language strange again.
I really like that idea of poets making language strange again. It's so poetic. I'm going to replay you just a wee snippet you've already heard to stress a final point about translation.
And this is really what the theory practice conundrum is about. These are different kinds of knowledge and require active translation between them, and that's highly skilled work.
And that's the rub. You must translate if you want the knowledge to work on the other side of the bridge. And if you think about our experiment, taking our academic paper back to the practitioners, that's exactly what plays out. The practitioners don't really connect with the theory because it's not translated. If you really want Scheduling for Christmas, the paper that tried, to work for people who make and schedule television, you'd have to write another version that translates the ideas back into a useful form for them. That way they get the value adding, the hybrid vigour that's happened to the paper in the translation required for the journal, but it's made meaningful for them in their context. The implications of seeing this as an epistemological gap rather than a theory practice gap are that it means what you need are skilled translators who are able to convert or translate the knowledge in one sphere or community into the knowledge of the other, and through their translational work, be able to talk to and understand each other. So this stresses the importance of the bridge. You have to invest in the bridge if you want to transfer knowledge, or if you want your research to be used by the other side. But the critical thing is, it has to be translated. As Howard says, that's one of the big things for universities to understand about working with academics who have come from practice.
Number one, they have to get away from this mythology that there is a single valid truth-making process in the world, and that is science. And you have this internal fight within the university about what that system is between typically the social sciences and the you know, soft and hard science, however, or arts and humanities, two cultures, you know, all of that massive literature and conversation that's about what kind of knowledge is knowledge within the university itself. But that's still a fight about who has the keys to the kingdom. What academia has to get away from is there's not a single set of keys. There's not a single kingdom. What there are is multiple kingdoms, and what you need is they all have the capacity to trade with each other, but what you need is people who can learn each other's languages.
I mean, you don't have to do this, but if you don't translate, you will only have bakers making bread for other bakers. If what you want is academics to talk to other academics, then you don't have to do anything. But if you think the point of research is to change the world, then you have to invest in the translation process and in opportunities for people to do it, and investing in people who do it well. They might be practice academics, they might be theorists, they might be people from practice, but find them and invest in them. So at the end of all this, I've hopefully answered all the questions I promised to. We know that to convert a piece of practice writing into a paper a journal would publish, we needed to make sure that the paper fitted the form and structure of academic writing, and we moved the knowledge from the particular to the universal and context-free by enriching the theory and stripping out agency, the actions of the individuals. We also worked out that collaborations with more experienced academics were really important for achieving this. We found out about some of the barriers that practitioners face when moving into academic jobs, the big one being that they go from being very senior and respected to becoming very junior and having to start from scratch to learn a completely new set of skills. We also identified that universities are often not good at recognising other systems of knowledge, so they're often not aware that there are other ways of making truth and knowledge, and these need to be recognised and understood. And we found out that in order to get knowledge across the bridge, to share knowledge between houses, you must translate. And that has to happen both ways. You have to translate. And finally, what gets lost in translation? Well, it's never perfect. You lose something. Just like me here, I'm trying to translate a formal academic paper into a story that you might want to listen to. And I have to adapt it. I have to miss things out, simplify things, abbreviate. It's not the same thing anymore. But maybe you've just listened to this because you wouldn't have read the paper. Or maybe you'll now read the paper and be able to make better sense of it because you've heard a translated version first. And the paper that tried, well, it got published. And from there, it helped us understand new things. There are plenty more questions to be asked, and that's how most academic papers end. They look forward to the next lot of questions that have come out of the work. And there's certainly plenty more work to be done, particularly around questions of effective translation. But it's also worth celebrating. Celebrating different ways of knowing, celebrating the generosity of spirit from Patsy, Maggie, Alan, Derek, Paul and Howard, people who all tried to say yes rather than no, and who trusted each other to make new things. And thanks to you for listening. We're trying to do something new here, trying another form of translation in telling this story in sound. It's another experiment, and they're never perfect. But as Voltaire is said to have said, perfect is the enemy of the good. So here we are, up on the shoulders of giants, adding our little chip to recognise and legitimise multiple epistemologies, multiple ways of knowing, and translating those different forms of knowledge to enable conversations that might be able to be heard by a whole lot more people. Audio footnotes. Good on you for hanging in there if you've made it this far. I've got some audio footnotes in case there's anything you might want to follow up on. But first, I want to clarify that even though it's my voice you hear, this is the work of three authors. Me, my name's Helen, Howard and Paul. My voice represents the collective I. If you want to find out about the two papers we've been talking about, the first one's called Scheduling for Christmas, How an Ordinary Piece of Television Became Extraordinary, and it was published in 2017 in the Journal of Popular Television. The second paper, the paper about the paper, is called Making Practice Publishable, What Practice Academics Need to Do to Get Their Work Published and What That Tells Us About the Theory-Practice Gap, and that was published at the end of 2019 in the Journal of Social Epistemology. The full reference list and usual academic details are available in those publications. And if you'd like to get in touch with any of us, we're very Googleable and we'd love to hear from you.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.